Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this week it is my absolute honor to welcome on the show firefighter, law enforcement officer, and the author of Demons and Angels, Dennis Peashock. So in this conversation, we discuss a host of topics, from Dennis's journey into the fire service, some of his powerful career calls, his mental health journey, his transition into law enforcement, teaching defensive tactics, catharsis through writing, and so much more. Now, before we get to this incredible conversation, as I say every week, please just take a moment. Go to whichever app you listen to this on, subscribe to the show, leave feedback, and leave a rating. Every single five-star rating truly does elevate this podcast, therefore making it easier for others to find. And this is a free library of over 1,200 episodes now. So all I ask in return is that you help share these incredible men and women's stories so I can get them to every single person on planet Earth who needs to hear them. So with that being said, I introduce to you Dennis Peashock. Enjoy. Well, Dennis, I want to start by saying thank you so much for taking the time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thanks for having me. I'm humbled. It's a huge honor. Thank you, James.
So where on planet Earth are we finding you this afternoon?
We are in Atlanta, Georgia, just outside of there, probably about 40 minutes outside in a suburb in a county called Forsyth County.
How did you guys do with this storm that we just had?
We did okay. Georgia, you know, doesn't do too well usually. They usually don't. But we did okay with this one. Let's just say that. We did. Everyone was pretty good. They salted earlier, which is good, which I usually don't do. But we survived. How about y'all?
I mean, it was gorgeous down here. We just had like 23 degrees at night. That was it. But yeah, nothing was needed to be done. No snow or anything. So I think we escaped the worst of it.
Yeah, 5 inches, nothing bad.
Yeah, brilliant. All right, well, let's start at the very beginning of your timeline then. So tell me where you were born and tell me a little bit about your family dynamic, what your parents did, how many siblings?
Sure, absolutely. 7 of us in total. 5 kids, grew up in a place called Norristown, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. Blue collar town, man, just hardworking. Everyone worked their tails off. A lot of folks stayed there, kind of that kind of town. You know, it used to be outside Conshohocken. You think about Allentown, kind of like your steel towns. And everyone grows up there and stays there, man. And grew up playing sports, of course. You know, we're outdoors all the time. Very different. I listened to your one buddy from FDNY, had him on, very similar to his life in New York. Lot of diversity with Italians, Polish, Irish, and just huge, huge communities. And everyone got along, man. Everyone played. And it was literally that you played till the lights came on at nighttime, and then you went in, and there was, you know, no cell phones, and everyone's outdoors, man. Grew up playing ice hockey, played football too, and everyone was playing sports. And you definitely played every single sport you could. Everyone was pretty much good at everything. It was extremely competitive and blue collar, man. Very blue collar.
I always ask people this, you know, when you're from a generation that just plays sports and you're playing lots of different sports, you're not specializing, you're not trying to become, yep, you know, the world champion in something. After you graduated, did you continue playing sports?
I did. So, I played in high school, of course. And then I got played Division II hockey, played up there too. So, just continue. And we grew up playing street hockey and pond hockey when anything froze, and everyone was pretty good. You know, everyone up there is just, it's pretty fine line there, who's going to make it or who's not. And after that, but almost everyone, man, everyone plays through high school. It's just standard.
And then once you graduate from college though, are you still playing sports?
I did. I played, I got into martial arts. So I was always into martial arts, and I continued to play ice hockey until about the age of 40 when I broke my femur, and that was the end of my hockey career right there.
It's just an interesting, I mean, I won't take a deep dive into this because I talk about it on here many times, but when you have someone who's got a background where they just played lots of sports and it was really for the love of the game, it was for fun, yes, they end up carrying on playing throughout adulthood. Yep. When you have, it seems, a high level of specialization and performance at a high school and college level, usually resulting in injury and or burnout. You have a lot of people in the US that used to be at a high level that now are very deconditioned and don't play anything at all. So I think it's a testament to, you know, not specializing, you know, enjoying sport for what it is, playing a multitude of sports, because there's a high chance that you're going to carry on and therefore maintain your fitness.
Totally agree. And I think it led us into our public safety professions in a way too. You know, we talked about childhood trauma can do that too, but your sports and that, that camaraderie and everything, people can't understand it. And you did it nonstop. You went from baseball season to football season to hockey season, and you were always surrounded by these different people. And everyone was ultra competitive, and everyone played for the love of the game. And I have a very difficult problem watching any pro sports now, because I can't even comprehend it when they say, well, I'm not going to practice today, I'm not going to play. We did it because we loved it every single day.
Well, you mentioned childhood trauma. Obviously, we're going to be talking about mental health in this conversation. Yep. When you reflect back now with this 2026 lens, knowing that a lot of us in uniform had things, you know, struggles when we were young, and if addressed, that becomes a strength, but it does kind of, you know, cause a lot of us to toe the line in the first place. What were elements of your upbringing you think that contributed to your struggles?
Different type of living too. So everyone, like you said, was kind of doing that. Everyone served, you know, everyone was in either World War II, Korea, Vietnam. So everyone in your family had previously served, and very different. Again, we'll get into that too. Grandfather was in massive battles, Battle of Leyte Gulf in the Navy, Battle of Okinawa, some huge naval battles. And he actually helped, I think it was at DD-214, I think it was at Peleliu too, bombed. So he was in massive battles. Gunner on a ship, never talked about anything, zero, ever. And you didn't talk about it. Like, if it got mentioned, grandma would smack you on the head. Do not bring this up in this household. And you knew it. Then my father was in Vietnam, and he passed a couple years ago, and he did not talk about it at all towards the end. And massive, massive trauma. All of his promotions in the field were combat promotions. His buddies got killed, and they said, Jim, you're next, you know, and very difficult. And you just knew, you know, those guys they definitely had that aura. Yeah, if you said something, they gave you that look, and the conversation was over. Like, you didn't even push it. You knew better.
And it's so sad when we have this conversation now, because I've actually had Iwo Jima wounded veteran on the show, and he talked about PTSD. He wrote a book about PTSD, which I thought was phenomenal, Frank Wright. But you hear a lot of the stories, and I know it's still kind of romanticized. There are a lot of World War II vets that came home and didn't have ticker tape parades, just went back to their, you know, farm town. But it, you know, they were still received somewhat as heroes. And you look at the Vietnam generation, of which I've had numerous people on, and it couldn't have been more different than that. And the moral injury that, you know, it must have been to serve your country overseas, whether you were drafted or whether you signed up, you know, wear the American flag and then come back to that. I can't imagine how destructive that must have been. And obviously, I know that's behind a lot of our suicides in our veterans of Vietnam.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, I had my father living at the time. And later on, as we got kind of a little bit more talking and all like that, and as we're getting older, I got to work with some Purple Heart guys. And when they served in Vietnam, got hurt, and their stories too are just insane. One guy got shot down in a helicopter, and he's coming back to the States on a plane. And he's riding with all the dead bodies in the back. He's the only live one. And the pilot lands at a spot, and he's like, hey, man, what did you say you did again? He's like, I got shot down. I got this Purple Heart. The pilot switched with him. He's like, I'm riding in the back now. You ride in the front. You're a hero. So pretty incredible, man.
Wow. Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had Major James Capers, who was one of the very first Marine recon soldiers or Marines, had a kind of incident with a helicopter. They were trying to evac after they'd all been shot. He jumped out because the bird couldn't take off. It landed again. His men grabbed him, pulled him in, and they were able to finally take off. Should have got a Medal of Honor, you know, for what he did. And he's, you know, badly wounded, comes back to stateside and is lying on the tarmac, and someone actually pisses on him while he's lying there on a stretcher. You know what I mean? But so many others spit and call baby killers and all this stuff. And, you know, most of these men just thought they were doing the right thing at the time or were even drafted. So I mean, this is why I like to ask our military veterans about the nuances, because it's not black and white.
No, it's not. You're so right. And it helps definitely with peer support and trauma when you start processing stuff. Like, these ladies and gentlemen definitely did as best as they could. Like, that's, we can't explain that. You just gave your life, did this, almost your life, and then someone comes back and takes a piss on you. Like, I mean, there's nothing to say.
No, exactly.
It's horrible.
Mm-hmm. Well, with your kind of career journey, when you were still in school, what were you dreaming of becoming back then?
It's funny, you know, because we grew up playing Cowboys, Indians, and the Green Army Man. That's how old I am, you know. So you're always dreaming military, and it was you're always pretending you were against Germany in World War II, and then Russia with the Cold War. So definitely want to go in the military. And my dad, man, he's an intense dude, and I told him I was going to join the Marines like him, and he lost his mind and scared the hell out of me. My dad was an intimidating dude, man. It was just different. He went to DI for a little bit, but he scared the shit out of me. So I was like, yeah, man, okay, you're going to go to college, because no one goes to college here. In this family, you're going to have a college degree. My brother just got one of the degrees, and we're going to follow up. So I said, okay, so I'm going to move out of this house. I eventually moved out. I was like, I got to serve, man. I have got to serve. And then really, it was between firefight and police, and I started with fire, and that's what I decided. I had to do something more. I just felt that definitely I was letting myself down.
What was 9/11 through your eyes? What was your experience that day?
So I was a firefighter for about 7 months at the time, a very busy area outside of Atlanta. Horrific. So, you know, I remember watching it on the video. We're actually doing IV practice that day for EMT school. And I couldn't hit a damn IV. That's how I always remember. And, you know, it's hard in the beginning. And they're like, get to the TVs, which was insane because you couldn't leave the classroom ever. And we went in there and we pretty much got there right before they fell down. And our instructors, you know, are the old salty vets. Like, you know how they are. You didn't cross them or nothing. And those towers went down. I looked over and one of them was crying. And I was like, holy crap. Like, this guy is, you know, Superman to you already. He's one of your instructors, and he's been doing this probably 20 years. And I was like, okay, this is pretty bad, man. And it hit me hard. And then the numbers started coming out that, you know, they didn't know at the time how many hundreds of firefighters and then so many cops were in there. And then of course the other one, and man, it hit hard. It definitely hit hard. Like I said, I was firefighter at the time. Guys started volunteering, get your gear. We want to go. We want to get up to New York. You know, we're in Philadelphia. So we want to get up there and help out. And the department was like, absolutely not. No one was allowed to go. And that hurt worse too, because you got all these gung-ho folks who were like, we'll go, we'll take PTO, we'll do whatever it takes to go help out. But yeah, man, it was a massive blow. And I knew I was in a pretty tough career real fast.
How competitive was it to get hired back then?
Oh God, we're going to go there. Huh? I'd listen to what your last podcast. Yes. All right. Anyway, very hard. So we had a 2-year waiting period. And so at the time I applied for the place I was at for 17, 18 years, and I applied for the city of Atlanta. And I was just waiting and waiting, man. I applied in like 99 and 2001. It was like 6 days before my 2 years came up. And I was like, I'm done. I'm moving on to a different career. Like, I can't wait. And of course I was working. And 2 years, man. And the PT test was no joke. You know, it was, they're like, are you claustrophobic? I was like, I don't know. They put the damn gear on me and they're like, go crawl through this tunnel. I'm like, okay, well, I want this job pretty damn bad. I waited 2 years. So I went, did really well. I was always in shape, man. I'm a PT fanatic. So did really well on the test, but you know, you just don't know how you're going to do in a tunnel either. It's pitch blacked out. And it was really interesting. And everyone's different trying. You see all these people fail next to you. And then all of a sudden, voila, man, I had a job. And it was, again, 2-year waiting list, and they were the cream of the crop.
And what was your first department?
It's called Gwinnett County. It's just outside of Atlanta. It's about 1 million citizens. I think they're about 17th top rated in the U.S. right now for call volume. They're pretty high.
So at the front door, what was, if any, the mental health conversation?
Zero. Oh my God. I still remember. So, you know, you're in training. It's your, we'll call it your hell week, whatever. So the one night you got to stay up all night, you know, and the instructors just, you run mock calls all night, but no sleeping allowed for over 24 hours. And I'll never forget it, man. The driver engineer and the other guys, old school dudes, they said, let's be effing clear. You do not talk about this job to your family or friends. They don't have a freaking clue. and don't waste your damn time. He said, and never your spouse either. I was like, okay. Of course, you listen to everything they say, and that was your mental health for the next probably 7 years right there.
What did you find yourself on vehicle-wise?
So it's pretty cool, man. When I first started, we had an E1 engine, which was an open cab. So it was pretty awesome, man. You didn't ride, like, I'm not that old, but at least you were sitting in a chair and it was open. So you had the elements, but it was cool as hell, man. You pulled up to cars next to you and you could, you know, look into the car. So it was an old school engine, man. It was pretty awesome.
And then as far as like assignment, were you engine guy for a while, truck guy? Where did you kind of
engine
specialize?
Engine guy for a long time. Yeah, engine guy. I was engine 23, super busy house, man. And you get your assignment the night before and this guy comes up to me. I'm like, station 23. It's like, is that? He's like, man, that's busy. Get ready. And first shift, man, fatality, house fire, boom, right from the get-go, man. It was nonstop.
So with that being said, then doesn't have to be, you know, the most grotesque by any means, but when you reflect back now on the fireside, what were some of the career calls that you ran?
Well, man, first of all, my book's got a lot of the harshest ones that and those are the ones I wrote to process when I started understanding trauma and all that. But, you know, I'd say a couple calls in, man, you know, I don't know where you want to go, how dark you want to go here, but,
dark as we had you a want. Couple.
I read your book, man, so I know you have you explain things well, man. So we had these chicks from Africa, man, and I mean Africa, like Kenya, and we saw them earlier in the night, and they were like, "Hey, fireman!" And my buddy's name is Black Cadillac, he's a huge black guy. He was a pimp in Chicago before becoming a firefighter. I'm not joking. So he's flirting, yeah, man. It's a whole nother story on its own. So they're flirting back and forth, and like, hey, so you know, we drive by. Probably about 5 hours later, whatever, how many hours, I don't remember now. You know, trauma's funny. Get a call, people hit by vehicle. Man, it's them. They got smoked, like, basically on an interstate, four lanes, multiple times by multiple cars. And we're talking pieces, hair, it's everywhere, man. And they're like, these are those girls, literally, you know. So you get to work, man, you know, engine and med unit, probably five folks on scene. So everyone's got a massive job to do, you know, on something like that too. So I had one patient, my black Cadillac had the other, man. And, it was rough, dude. And, they both died, of course, but, you know, your parts sticking out. And, I remember this for my trauma part, man, he was sitting on the curb after the call and the ambulance took off, you know, we do two lines, try to get what you can on him. He had a damn eyeball on his hand and he's like, P, he called me P. He's like, look, man, it was one of the damn girl's eyes, man, just sitting in his freaking hand, man, on the side of the road. And, you know, you keep running calls. You try to process your shit, but you don't. 2 hours later, 1 a.m., whatever, you get a call. Need a wash down. PD's out there. The road is so bad. We got to go do a wash down. You know what that is. Got to get booster line. And so, man, it was a trifecta that night just on one call. And that was 2-3 shifts in, man.
Brutal. That reminds me, yep. when I first became a standalone medic in Orange County outside of Orlando, one of my very first call, you know, the first shift at least, it was in the nighttime, but I don't know what exactly had happened, but these two pedestrians decided they want to cross, kind of like you're talking about, like a six lane, you know, road, and just got creamed by a taxi. And so I pull on scene, you know, one of my first calls as a standalone medic. There's an experienced medic on the engine that's working them, but he turns to me and goes, you know, should we call it? And I'm like, fuck, I don't know. Let's have a look. And so we start, you know, doing the assessment, listen to what they were telling me. And then one of the other guys says that there's brain matter. And I'm like, okay, then we're going to call it. Thank you for that sign. But yeah, I mean, God, to go from, you know, whatever we were doing prior, you know, watching TV or drinking coffee or whatever it was, to then, like you said, and it's even worse. God, if you've actually interacted with those people prior as well, but
correct,
the finality of a brutal call like that, it's heartbreaking. It really is.
It is, man. And again, no peer support. You were told to un-F yourself. That's it. This is what you signed up for. Next call, man. You go home, do it again. And that's how those, you know, those stations don't stop. They don't care. And you love it. Of course, you love it for years until you finally find out something is happening to you.
Absolutely. Well, what about Swiftwater Rescue? I saw that was one of your specialties. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, man. So that's a whole nother story. So yeah, man, I got promoted, you know, to driver, and just how it works out. Like, you're going to the Swiftwater team. I'm like, Jesus, I haven't swam in years. I'm like, okay, you know. So go out there for the tryouts, and again, PT fanatic, man. I'm in good shape, but swimming doesn't care. You know, the river does not care what kind of shape you're in. You can do pull-ups all day and push-ups, but if you ain't doing this motion, so yeah, man, I take the swim test. I go there, and the swim test was funny. It's like a 50-meter sprint, then you tread water for 10 minutes and then do something else. I'm like, okay, I'm surviving, but I'm starting to hurt pretty good here. And then it was, I think it was a 400-meter swim test, and I can't remember whatever time it was. I made about four laps and drowned. I just went right to the bottom. I'm like, I have nothing left. I can't even, you can't fake it. Your body starts cramping because you don't use any of these muscles. And I was like, I got issues. And they're like, all right, well, here's the deal, man. You got 2 weeks. Swim test is back. You're off the team and you're out of the station. I said, okay. And type A personality, man. I'm like, okay, game on, man. So right to the pool every single day and went back, passed the swim test. And then, you know, Swiftwater team, man, we do the hooch here, Chattahoochee. It doesn't play, man. It doesn't care. It's 7 miles an hour, which is fast. People don't understand how fast that is when they're flowing. And got on the team, lots of knots, you know, lots of knots, man, which again is another took me a long time to learn all these damn knots, but it paid off. And then you start doing a lot of body recoveries, unfortunately. I don't know how to say it, but anyway, man, just a lot of illegals per se, and they can't swim well. And some of the flatter parts of water, like the ponds, they just walked out and just kept walking out. It gets deeper, but they keep walking out and they literally die and the water is just above their head. That's it. And we've had a lot of those. You just go in maybe with a pike pole or just a quick John boat and pull them out, whatever you have, any kind of flotation. But then the floods, man, the floods were something else in 2009. That was really different. Definitely had some rescues. And like I said, when the river is flowing, man, at full, that dam is open. There's no explanation. It is relentless. It's the most powerful thing in the world. Firefighting is incredible, but definitely a water rescue is pretty phenomenal, man. And in 2009, we had the floods here, which was the storm of 500 years. It was exactly like what happened to Texas. And we got it, man. In 2009, I was on the team, and it was a hell of a night, to say the least.
Talk to me about that night. What were some of the notable rescues or heroism or community that you witnessed?
Definitely, man. And that's we can go into this, and I'll do my best. Still screws me up sometimes, but anyway. So it's pouring, man. It was pouring for like 3 days. And just, you know, the ground super saturated and all that. So we go to work and you're like, oh, it's not too bad. It's pounding off the metal roof, the tin roof. So go to bed about 11 o'clock at the first dispatch, get rung out. You know, you're trying to get some sleep because you're figuring, but you don't know what the hell is going to go on here. I think we got like 20 inches in like an hour. It was insane. You know, just this God storm from Moses, basically. So, yeah, man, we get to work. And first rescues were pretty simple. We had to get the boat to this place. I think it was Yellow River. And we almost lost the boat. When we started going across a bridge to get to where everything was, the water was so high, almost took our boat right off the back. But we made it, man, and we started roping in, and people were just stuck on porches and houses. So in the beginning, it was pretty simple. We start a rope system, you know, kind of walk across, walk them back. And we're high-fiving, man, like, this is great. Like, we got this. You know, we're like, this is so easy, man. But that was only the beginning, man. And then those were the days of the map books. So it was comical. And we were like 30 miles away from our first end. So nobody knew where the hell they were going. And then we would drive somewhere and you couldn't go there because the water was too high. And they're like, okay, get the map book out, man, and start trying to find where these people are calling. And every single call was for Swiftwater at this point. We're the only boat in the water yet. The backup team was not deployed. So I don't know how many of us were in there. Probably 8 of us. Anyway. So yeah, man, just start getting crazier and crazier and crazier, and just different rescues. We had to tie off to the ladder truck one time, man, and pull some people off. And the craziest call is, is it okay if I tell it? Is it all right?
Yeah, say whatever you like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. So we get this call, and it was a dam broke in the area, and it just didn't make sense. You know, we talk about trauma. The mind can't process some shit. It just can't. Like when we have a horrible pediatric fatality, your mind kind of splits. It doesn't comprehend it, goes into that protection mode, and then you know, we go to the next call. But that's just the protection defense of the human body. It's pretty incredible. So we get out there, man, and we have like 2 firefighters, maybe 4 cops, and maybe 4 civilians trapped on a house. So we're like, okay, it's ours. It's all our guys too. So we start setting up, start setting a tack team out there, man. And they start roping off and there's nothing. This water is like probably 3 to 4 feet high and it is flying. And it just doesn't make sense. We're in the middle of like a damn road. Like, where the hell is all this water coming from? Well, a dam broke so many miles down. And when they made it to the house, James, it's a two-story house. The water was on the roof. So again, how the hell is this water 24 foot in the air flowing over a house? Like, nobody can comprehend it. So the attack team needed more help. So I went out there. I was on the second team. We started getting Carlson boards. Like, they're kind of boogie boards. I don't know if you know what those things are.
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. Tying all your damn rope systems. You find out what the hell doesn't work real quick in this shit. You start cutting rope systems that are useless in a real, real life has a funny way of changing theory. Let's just say that. So guys are figuring it out, man. And you just had to make some swims. And the first team was like, you know, you got to go 15 feet. And that water was flying and make the jump. And it was like, okay, James, make the jump, man. And, you know, we probably should be dead here because we're probably not going to see you again because strainers in the water, trees going by too. Because remember, a dam broke and you're just going to get caught up. But they made it, man. And we were able to tie some rope systems there too. And guys are swimming and carrying gear too. And again, like a gun, the water is the ultimate equalizer. No matter what shape you're in, what skill level, it's gonna make you work, man. So we got to these guys. We got the civilians all first, of course. Then we got the police officers, man. And those dudes were freaking out. Now I didn't understand why, but I didn't care because we had rescues to do. We had our two guys still too, and we got them back, and then we got our two guys back too, and. Like, man, we got to go back. And it was just the craziest silence, man. It was almost like an evil. I can't explain it. The quiet was just, it was just the water. And it was like something else out there, man. It was real strange. But to make a long story short, man, we made it back. We got all the systems back. And then had a couple more rescues that night where we had to go swim out to a car. The backup team was at a different place where a woman was stuck in the car. And they actually had her on the phone, the battalion chief and the lieutenant, talking to her like, they're coming, and she died with them on the telephone, man. So, you know, heavy trauma for them too, man, you know, on the phone with her. And so we kept going, man, and we got our people out of our cars, but the backup team lost that person, and we probably had 30, maybe at least 30 rescues that night, and most of us should have been dead. That's the bottom line.
Crazy. With the phone call, it reminds me Beth Bowersox I had on the show. She was a dispatcher at the Paradise Fire, and that is, you know, the unsung heroes of the first responders are the people.
Definitely.
On the end of the line.
Yep.
Because they are so helpless and they don't get closure. A lot of times they don't know, did the line go dead because they hung up because we showed up, or did it go dead because, you know, they were consumed by fire? So
right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Awful.
Mm-hmm. It is, man. And one of those things too. So, you know, went home. That was the only time they said you can't go home because you guys are it. Like, you're not going home until these floods recede. And again, you go look up this, the storm of the 500 years, the damage was insane. How many billions of dollars and how many lives were lost. But we killed it, man. We crushed it in that regard. And different Swiftwater rescue teams around the areas, they did awesome too. We did as best we could, for sure. And when I went home, man, that's when shit hit. Like, I that fatigue and everything finally hit, and then the depression and mental health definitely struck me. And definitely learned about that later when we had to go to the defusing and the debriefings, and that was just beyond eye-opening, man. But yeah, I went home, and again, my dad's a combat vet. He was. And talked to him on the phone, and I'm telling him what's happening, and he just cut me off. He said, "Dennis, you were in combat." And you know, for him to say that, never, ever. And he looked at me and he stopped me in my tracks, said, "You were just in combat. Move on. It's over." And, you know, he didn't want to talk about it anymore, but I'll never forget that either.
You mentioned about the police being the police freaking out. Was there a specific reason you uncovered, or was it just simply the situation?
We did, man. We did. Can we go into the debrief and all? Is that okay?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yeah, man. So this is crazy. And again, it's in my book. This definitely fucked me up, dude. So we go to the debriefing, and it's the chief's like, "Hey, I need you guys." Sorry about cursing. I apologize.
No, you can curse. I usually do.
All right. So, you know, it's probably back then it was probably 2 weeks later. It was a little too late, but that's fine. And like, "You guys need to go." And we're like, "We're not going. You know, we're running calls. We're too cool. We're type A's." Like, the chief's like, "You're going. You'll be there. I'm picking you all up." But that was that crew, man. The crew was just jam up awesome dudes, man. You know what it is. When you get the specialty teams, man, those guys want to be there, and you're going to drag them out. So we're thinking, okay, we're going to go and meet maybe 5-6 people. That was our first legit debriefing, man. It was dispatch, every police officer. I don't even know if there was, it was probably 40-50 people, man. And that's where I got a taste of what this job was. And I've been in officer-involved shooting. I've been on a line of duty death. I wasn't even 2 years on. We had our first line of duty death. So I've been on bad calls. But this was where mental health got me, man. This is where, because everyone had to do their talk. So they came to you and you can skip. So dispatch said theirs. And it, like you said, it was intense, man. I was like, I had no idea. I had no idea. You know, radio's going dead, but it wasn't dead for this time for someone was dead. It was going dead because of water and the heavy rain. So and of course, dispatch is losing their minds and because they love us. You know, they do. They truly love us. And I never knew that because you're always yelling at them, talk better, louder. So it was really good to hear their perspective. And then the cops got up, man, and they were screwed up. And I think they all quit not that long after. And I didn't understand why. One guy got carried by the water. I think his face got stuck to a fence and electrocuted, burned his entire face. But water is the great equalizer, man. And when they did their speech as a man to a man, it hit me. It haunted me. Because I realized that, you know, we're not superhuman anymore. So afterwards, man, it was time for our talk. Not one of us on the damn team talked. Not one. And we should have. But we were too screwed up from these cops who were so honest. And they were like, I don't think I'm doing this job anymore to 50 strangers. And I was like, holy shit. And you could hear a pin drop in that room. And none of us talked, and we should have, but, you know, whatever. And then, so at the very end, man, we're breaking up, and we're all like, no one's cutting up, you know, because we know. We got punched in the face is what happened. And that's what this job does to you. Those cops came up to us and wanted to thank us. Bro, they broke down. Whew, it was tough. And they were like, hey, ma'am, you know, I'm only here because of you, my daughter. And that's tough to take, man, when you hear that.
It's beautiful at the same time, though. I mean, this is what all the training culminates for is, you know, we might have this once in an entire career.
Yep. It is, man. And every time we talk about it, it's still like when you make that influence on someone's life and they're like, my kid wants to thank you. It's like, shit, man. Like you know. And then, you know, then you did your job, man. You did. You did what you're supposed to do. And you affected the guys next to you, not just a civilian. You know, now you saved those lives. And they all quit, man. They all quit. And that's what really hit me. It's like, it's not my identity all of a sudden. You know, it's not. So it was tough, man.
Talking and listening to what you're saying, it reminds me when I went to my first department, which was Hialeah, we had to do a pretty stringent swim test. I mean, genuinely, like, you know, laps underwater and, you know, some basic towing and all that kind of thing. And I had a lifeguard background, so I was okay with it. But Hialeah has canals running down it. And so you're not really in long bodies of water. I think there was one pond in one of the parks, Amelia Earhart Parks. We did some diving in that. But they had every rig had scuba tanks. So every one of us was expected to do some sort of dive rescue.
Right.
And then we did like a kind of a very condensed version up to rescue diver. And I already had my advanced then, but we didn't get the rescue cert. But again, you know, we're doing dive training for like a full week and in the shittiest places, not, you know, not beautiful ocean. Right. But it really made me think because when I worked for Orange County, which is the one around Orlando, there are lakes everywhere. And there was no requirement to be able to swim whatsoever. And I ended up getting assigned to a boat station. My engineer was a former lifeguard as well. And there was no training on, you know, how to, like, official training on how to drive the boat, back it into the lake, how to go in, how to backboard in the water, you know, none of that stuff. So we obviously ended up putting our own training together. And I would argue we were probably the best trained crew of the three shifts at the time.
Yep.
But we would have people float into the station that had no idea, and some of them couldn't even swim. So you put that in that situation, someone's drowning, and this person's either fumble fucking trying to get the boat in the water in the first place, or they can get to the person, but they can't actually get in and pull them out. So it's something that we don't really discuss in the fire service as much. And don't get me wrong, if you're in a place with zero bodies of water, then I get it. You don't need a swim test. But for anyone, you know, where you have lakes and ponds and rivers and streams and canals, you know, that really should be a prerequisite for any position.
Yeah. And we trained hard, man. You had to, you had swimming pool training, I think every, you know, every Tuesday or Wednesday, whatever it was. So you were swimming there too. And almost every ship, you were taking the boat out. So that at least four guys took the boat out on the hooch, and everyone else ran all the calls. And then next shift, you guys swapped out. So yeah, man, you're always getting your driver training in, rescue diver, whatever it was. So no, man, guys, everyone knew their roles well, but when the floods came, everyone knew exactly where they were going to. Like, you don't, it's not training time, man. This is go time. So yeah, good training. Yeah. Great training.
Now that department had a good chief Rhodes that came right when I left, and they were developing skin diver into rescue diver. Now they have actual programs in place. But you know, when I was there, it was all the way up to 2013, and there was nothing at that time. So it's crazy to think, you know, we'll talk about the mental health and the lack of, you know, conversations and tools there. Well, even operationally, how many departments are kind of winging, you know, brush fires, water rescues, et cetera.
Totally. And that's where you get your good crews, man. And they're like, we'll take our own training, which is still today, as you know, we'll take our own training in our own hands. And that's the beauty of before us, the guys who wrote the policies and do this stuff. You always got to give them credit and thank those guys. But yeah, man, training is everything. You know, you will not rise up, man. Your training, and especially on the water, you have zero chance. The river doesn't care.
What were some of the things that you were taught would work in training that didn't seem to work in the real world, at least the application that you were in?
Well, you had like Z rigs and Prusiks and stuff like that. And people, the water people know this, and knots people, man, there was zero time, and safeties and backup safeties. No, get rid of them. And like seconds count, like seconds do count, man. I just remember having a knife and cutting Prusiks off. Like, get rid of this crap right now. Get rid of it. No time at all. You know, you're 2-1, 3-1, advantages, just there was just nothing, man. When the first guys who went out, the first team, I give them all the credit, man. I was second team. These guys had to set up, and there was nothing. They're like, okay, is that street sign going to hold us? And they're waiting out, man. They could have been pulled out at any time and just shot downstream. And they just found anchor points, man. And we just figured it out with knot systems. But as far as backups and everything, you didn't have time, and you're carrying rope too. It's like carrying a hose. You still only have 250 feet of 1¾ inches. It's the same thing of this rope. If you're tying backups, you're losing, you know, rope. It's the same thing. You just don't have time, and you're extending yourself. So I would say the Prusik was definitely one we cut and got rid of. And again, it has its purpose. This was just a totally different, unique situation.
Well, I mean, that seems to be the contrast between, for example, a hazmat operation, which we all know is far slower than we realize until we start training with those guys.
Yep.
But I've said this, you know, for example, you have someone trapped under a car and you pull on scene. Yep. Do you want to be pulling out airbags and, you know, cribbing, or are you a crew that trains a lot? You put your back to the car, you lift the car while someone slides that person out. I mean, there has to be a point where, you know, yes, if you have the time for redundancy and safety, absolutely, it makes perfect sense. If you're going to be going between two buildings and someone's in a Stokes basket and you've got time, then you want to make as safe as possible. But, you know, there's certain areas where, I mean, we see an FDNY when they do those rope rescues over the side.
Absolutely.
That's just one guy belaying off the top and the other one's just kind of wrapped around his waist, so, or her waist. So I think that's an important conversation, because we have the cops that will kick in a door and a fire and go in there with no protection and pull someone out and they'll get an award.
Yes.
And the fire service, if you don't go in with your partner, you're freelancing and you get written up.
Yep, exactly. Well, we have this place, it's called Drowning Rock, because when the river comes up, it flows. It comes up really high, and it's a huge rock. But when it flows, the river doesn't care. It goes up probably at least 10, 12 foot way over the rock. So you have fishermen who fish out there, and they ignore the sirens. One rescue we had, and they're wearing waders, so they're dead. You know, that water catches them, they're gone. And Drowning Rock for a reason. And we had just to talk about theory and practice, man, you're on a time frame. So that call comes out, you got to bunker out. You got to get all your rope stuff on this. You got to go. And this guy has minutes, right? And we're pretty close. But anyway, we get out there and we see the guy out there on the rock. Water's coming up. And there's a huge strainer, which is a tree that went down and you can't see. It's got all of its, basically, if you fall in water, you're dead. It pulls you and just kills you. And he's right next to a strainer too. And our driver, man, phenomenal. he's, you know, he's getting the boat close, but we can't get close enough, and I'm the rescue guy. And again, theory is he's going to jump in the boat, we're just going to pull him in. Well, we get about a foot away, which is incredible because we can't have anything get sucked up into the boat or kill us. We're dead in the water. This guy, then instead of, I go to grab him, he pulls back, pulls me head first into the damn tree, about knocks me unconscious. And I'm like, my other rescue driver falls in the water. I'm like, well, this guy's dead. And now I have pretty much a concussion. So I grab this dude. I'm pissed as shit. Throw him on the ground, shake it off. I'm like, where the hell is our rescue diver? He's thank God, awesome. He's on top of one of the damn tree limbs. And like, so we go and get him and get back. But yeah, man, I had a concussion. I went back to the doctors. I had a huge contusion, but, that's real life, man. People freak out and they will kill you, especially in the water, just like that.
Do the public know it's called Drowning Rocks? That sounds like a fucking awful place to go fishing. They do. It'd be like going to Herpes Corner. I wouldn't go there either.
Of course they do. It's like, let's go there and go fish. Yes, they do, unfortunately.
One more area. One more thing in Swiftwater. Got to go up to the Guardian Center in Georgia a few years ago and get a tour. It was amazing, absolutely incredible, the training potential of that facility. With you being in Georgia and being Swiftwater, did you ever train over there?
Never. Nope. We trained. Everything was in-house and on the Chattahoochee. And we would actually go to Six Flags in Cobb County, and all the Swiftwater teams would go there and train. So it was pretty incredible. So you had the best of the best, man, once a year. And it was either 2 or 3 days of training with everybody. So you got great mutual training, man, with everybody. So if you had a big incident, you knew exactly who everybody was too. And everyone was on the same page, man. So it was really good stuff.
Gotcha. What about martial arts? You kind of alluded to that early in life. I've been a lifelong martial artist myself. What was the first one that you did? And walk me through the progression, how you ended up teaching defensive tactics.
Sure, man. So I was in high school and it's funny. I went to high school with two Japanese friends and very strict Japanese household. Mother's from Japan. So they're like, we're going to introduce you to a martial art. And that was like going into heaven. Like they would never introduce you to their sensei or whatever. So they're like, we think you're ready. You know, this is how you got to act because I'm, you know, like a dumb Westerner. I'm going to say something stupid, right? So bring me into this old Aikido school where the guy actually trained with those sensei, the founder. And man, it was awesome. It was just a beat down. It was old school martial arts. And I was like, I am hooked. You know, I'm loving this. I was already playing ice hockey and all that, but I'm like, this is exhausting. And just incredible. They brought this Marine guy came and he was like, I want to check this out. I don't believe in this. Got instructors like, okay, let's go. Man, he beat the hell out of this Marine. This dude was huge for like 2 minutes. And the Marine submitted, which was insane. And I'll never forget, because I know my dad is a Marine. Like, there's no way in hell. When this guy tapped out, I was like, I was done. I was like, what? Like, it wasn't even fathomable. And this was probably, you know, late 80s. I was like, damn, man, I'm digging this pretty good. So trained in that for years, man, a long time. Then I got a kind of Okinawan karate shuriryu. Got into that a little bit. I kind of like the harder style, too. And eventually, I've trained in everything, man. I've done seminars all over the place, too. And again, Brazilian jiu-jitsu, some jiu-jitsu then too. Went to Japan in 2012, did some competing and training over there, and then got into defensive tactics. It's just a natural progression, man.
I've told this on here a few times. What was funny for my journey is, you know, I did Shotokan originally. I think Shotokan, WTF Taekwondo originally, then Shotokan for a while, then ITF Taekwondo, which I won national titles, and I'm like, okay, well, I must be somewhat decent at fighting. And then I went to boxing and got murdered and realized I wasn't, and then started kickboxing, and then was doing my tippy tappy taekwondo stuff and got my standing leg completely destroyed. And okay, well, I'm not good at that either. Then got into jiu-jitsu, and then like, oh, and then if you fall down, I'm terrible at that too. So it was like this constant, you know, always humbling. Now there is that cumulative, you know, knowledge, of course. And the martial arts, the taekwondo served me well, doing the stunts that I did my whole career as well. But it was, you know, it was a kind of deconstructing of everything you've learned and trying to you know, refine what actually will work, you know, and what works for you. Totally. Like, I'm long, I'm not super powerful. So, you know, what is your style in the end? What has been your journey from Aikido originally, which I did for a few months, from Aikido all the way through to where you are today?
Man, it's been long. It's nonstop. I don't roll like BJJ anymore, really. My body's beat up, man. I mean, this job has destroyed me too. I definitely need some surgeries and stuff, but I have my own garage gym, and I still do what you would call an MMA in there. I got heavy bags and do a lot of heavy kegs and put everything together now, man. But no, it was an introspective journey, like you said. You find out what works and doesn't work, and you have to drop your ego when some dude can whoop your ass, because there's always someone better than you, and all the time. Like, just get rid of that ego. And you, the biggest thing is, as a beginner, just know it's going to be okay. Just tap out fast, learn something, and just keep. And that's why I always used to go to different seminars, man, and just learn from different people. Always wore a white belt, you know, I didn't care. Mm-hmm. Hey, you train? Nope, don't train in anything. And just go in there and learn their style for the, you know, day or two, and just take it for what it was, man. But now me, I'm, you know, I would say as old school guys are pretty much original MMA, because we're always doing different stuff in that regard. We are always trying to be more well-rounded. Boxing, like you said, hitting stuff, always striking. And when you go to the Aikido seminar, then they'll be like, you guys don't do Aikido. Like, yeah, we do. Like, no, this none of, and nothing you do here is Aikido. Like, yeah, man, it's the real stuff. And like, yeah, you're really not welcome here. So we also got that side too.
Yeah, the Aikido I did, I really loved it, but it was called Ki Aikido, and it was kind of a lot of that, you know, grab my hand, no, grab the other hand, you know. And
oh,
so
yeah, know it well.
You definitely got an introduction into, you know, using someone else's force, which, you know, I mean, that applies to a lot of things. There is value to that. Obviously, some of the wrist locks and, you know, the places that the joints can go and can't go. So was really, really good. But yeah, that was very reminiscent of it. Worked well if you came in this one particular plane with this right arm versus, you know, what we see in the madness of a real fight where, you know, the original barrage, you're just trying to survive, and then whatever you can grab hold of, you're like, okay, I think I know where I am now. And that's where you really start, you know, going.
And FD definitely taught me a lesson. All the years in FD, I would definitely put it together. You know, you have someone on drugs or diabetic that you couldn't get a wrist lock on that person. Like, they're trying to kill you because they have no idea what is happening to them. And then once I eventually got to police work, it's full on fights, man. It's very different too. You know, it's survival in the dojo, whatever. You're not killing this person. There's always a tap out. There's a choke out. No, man. In police work, they're trying to kill you. It's very different mentality.
I had Tony Blauer on several years ago. Now talk to me about spear and how you value that in the overall system.
Oh my God, man. Very eye opening too. Already order martial artist, black belt. And, you know, during COVID, we couldn't train. No one could train anymore. So I found Tony online, man, and he started doing Zoom classes. I'm like, this is so dumb. Like, how is this going to work for martial arts? Because, but Tony, his situational awareness and the way his mindset approaches things is second to none, man. Him and Chief Pearson, just unbelievable, man, what they say. And then when they take our job basically and relate it, because, you know, Tony pretty much, you know, he's trained SEALs, Delta Force, he's trained everybody. And when she starts seeing that and the mindset that he gets you for, the fear loop's incredible. He talks about when we play sports. He's like, I'm this good, but why am I always afraid? And that was the same thing. And I played ice hockey forever. I was a goalie, man. And it's a total mind screw at all times. Like, I'm making all these saves, but that negativity is still in the back of my head. Like, what is going on here, man? And he does really good with addressing the mind and real fights and how they happen so close. And nonviolent posture. So yeah, man, I started training with Tony for years online until we got back into gear. And then a couple of years ago, I went up and trained with him in York, Pennsylvania, and got my spear certification. And man, for police work and firefighters, I cannot recommend it enough. It is just outstanding. It's a mindset, and it's not a martial art. It's a total mindset. He calls it the airbag. It's a shock where it gets your flinch response into action. And it's incredible because it's what Tony always says. It's not what you think what you're going to do. It's what you're going to do. If a spider drops on the ceiling, you're going to do this. Everyone says, well, I wouldn't blink. Okay. And then you drop something on their head and they go like this. It's human nature, man. And he just plays off that body and body mechanics. And his thought process is incredible.
Beautiful. Well, you mentioned law enforcement. So what made you transition from the FD side to the PD side?
You know, definitely the trauma, horrendous command staff, just absolutely horrendous. They definitely start targeting people and going after you. And it was my turn for the bullseye, man. You know, when these aren't just bad people, these are evil people. And, there's a lot documented, but anyway, that's when the job is getting to you and then your command staff is definitely after you, things are a whole nother different level, man. And, mandatory overcame in 2013, and they still do it now a lot. 48 hours on, 24 hours off. Nobody knows. Keep it down low. But they're probably working, a new guy is probably working 7 to 8 shifts extra a month. Exactly. So they don't give two shits. Give me 2 or 3 years out of you now, and that's it. So when that started, I tell everyone this story. I was at the original meeting. I'm like, this can't fly. They're like, oh, it'll be okay. I'm like, it'll never be okay. It'll never go away. Still going on today, 13 years later. My daughter said she was like 7. I was missing another birthday, and she said, "It's okay, Dad. We're used to you not being here." She had no idea, and I was like, "F my life. This is it. This is it." And me and my wife, like, we're done. And then that was it. So that's when the transition. But no, they definitely helped push us out too. They definitely and went on to the other side.
When you reflect back now, because what you're talking about is Marion County here, is Orange County. I mean, you know, These are departments that, you know, when I was at Orange was 08 to 2013. And when I was there in 08, it was mandatory all the time, especially They were screaming for medics. I put myself through medic school. They gave me zero tuition reimbursement or support. And then, you know, put me in the meat grinder as well. I mean, it was, you know, that organizational betrayal that we talk about.
Totally.
But what really just blows my mind, I think maybe I even alluded to this in that last article, I can't remember, but I don't understand how you are once in a fire academy with everyone else wearing bunker gear, doing the tunnels, you know, doing the claps mazes and all these things. And then fast forward 10, 15 years later, you're pushing papers in a desk, knowing that the men and women, you know, that working under you are getting crucified. Yep. Really, working hours because of your mismanagement, and you still sleep fine at night. I do not understand that outside of that is also a mental health issue that we're not addressing. Because only a sociopath would be able to sleep when their men and women are being worked into the ground.
Well, and that's what I call the evil side. So I'll tell you, it was in 2017, it got so bad. And, you know, I call them the sheeple. Those are the guys who agree with the chiefs no matter what. Well, he's a good guy. He just can't do anything. No, he's in a freaking leadership position. It's his damn job to do a lot better than this. So they started saying, you know, the chief's supposed to be up. His shift changes at 7. Chief's supposed to be up at 6 a.m. having manpower locked out. So you knew if you were on mandatory or not. So people were calling like, do I have to stay late? I have a life. So finally they said after 6 months, the chiefs were tired of this because no one was working anymore. They said, do not call us ever again. So if you called the chief to see if you had to work mandatory, you were written up. So they would put paper on you too. Then it finally became the next year that you had to find your own staffing in the morning. You had to find your own damn manpower to go home if you wanted to go home. So I'll tell you a story about a guy, and he quit shortly after, thank God. Phenomenal dude, and he helped me definitely get out. But so this buddy finds his driver, because only guys can drive certain apparatus and all that. He gets James to come in to work. So he's like, yeah, James has got me covered 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. 7:05 comes, he's not there. 7:15, he's still not there. He's calling, the guy's not answering. They're basically telling this guy, don't answer the phone. He finally calls the chief, and they're like, why are you calling me? He's like, has anyone seen this guy? He's like, yeah, I took him. I moved him somewhere else. You're staying anyway. And he's like,
oh my God.
Yes. So he found his own manpower. They said, thanks for doing my job because I'm useless. And he said, okay, no problem. He had to stay till like noon, then went home, and he's like, I'm done. He quit. So it was great. Good for him, man. But that's how bad it became. And it's still horrible, but they hide it very well.
Well, this is what blows my mind. You know, you've probably seen the stuff that I put out trying to help these departments go to 24/72. And again, I'm merely just, you know, creating the conversation, bringing resources on the physical side and the mental side, and then departments that have done it. It is not James Gearing doing this by any means. It's the amazing men and women in these departments have the balls to say, it's not working. Let's do something different.
Yep.
But I'm just about to get the Gainesville guys on. They're supposed to be this morning, but they had to reschedule. But now we're having departments telling, you know, what a huge success this is, and you know, the money that they're saving, and that every, you know, there's no vacancies now. Every single spot that's filled, like Pasco County was three shifts understaffed 2 years ago. Now they're 4 fully staffed shifts. And about 2 weeks ago, they went to 24/72. 2 years.
Love it.
And it's a county, all they had was a 6-week Kelly before. That's it. So
incredible.
When you have these answers, this is what drives me crazy. And I relate to your friend, because when my last shift, I finally got to get off the rescue and be on the engine, riding up, driving for a shift, ran a code, got back and was told, actually, you're going to be on the rescue the rest of the shift and you're on the bubble to be mandatory. And I'm a single dad at this time. And I've gone through the process with another department and I'm still waiting to do the medical. And I was like, you know what? Fuck this. You right. cannot tell a single father that he can't go home to his child. It just doesn't yep. fucking work like that.
They don't care at all.
No. So I was like, all right, well, I'm not going to be here next shift because I fucking quit. And I put my papers in right there and then, and
good for you.
Know, and then took the leap, luckily passed the, you know, the medical, which I was assuming I would, and then got hired at the other place. But yep. it was just one of those things where, you know, people have lives, people have marriages, yep. people have relationships with their children and promises yep. to be at events that you are destroying. And you yep. go home at 5 o'clock every night. Yep. So anyone that's listening, that's in that position, look yourself in the mirror and ask yourself, how the fuck is that fair?
Bingo.
It's not. And so either one of two things, either A, you kind of have a realization, you say, you know what, you're right. We have to actually do something about it. This isn't fair. And this is why I'm making the salary that I am with the bugles on my shirt. Or, you know, it's why I'm the union president or vice president, because some of them are fucking awful too. It's yep. time for me to step up. Or B, you realize that you just don't have the guts to be in that position. You need to step down, let someone with a set actually do it. Because these are real human lives. And we all know that sleep deprivation is directly correlated with everything from obesity and testosterone depletion to cancer, suicide, and addiction.
Yep. Absolutely, man. And, you know, it's funny, and I'm sure you, because it was the other guy, when he walks out, all the guys are like, well, he sold us out, man. That's where we eat our own, too. Like, that guy, he shouldn't have been here anyway. He wasn't ready for this job. No, man. That's the only damn guy who had balls and said, I'm done with this shit. I'm getting out of here, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's not a lack of love of the job. We all love the job. But
oh, God. Absolutely.
Were you told that you were going to work 8 hours a week in Fire Academy? I wasn't.
Nope.
So it's not the job. Mm-hmm. It's the working conditions. And the guys now, in men and women in Pasco County and Gainesville, they're working 42 hours a week and loving the job. And they are rested and chomping at the bit to get back for the next shift. That's how it's supposed to be.
And who gets better care? The civilians, the public. It just all works. Yep. Instead of, this is how we've always done things, suck it up. Yep.
100%. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to go to your mental health journey, but let's just continue the career story. So you take the leap from FD to PD. Talk to me about that transition. And then, what was the leadership that you were under in that?
Oh, night and day, man. Thank God. I would say, you know, my first 10, 12 years, the Chiefs were phenomenal in FD. Just phenomenal. Like you talked about, they did what you did and they carried it on. They were incredible. Unfortunately, we transitioned to these horrible individuals from other departments, brought them in, weren't really firefighters, full-time paramedics, and didn't care much for the fire side. Well, this is a 1,100 person department of all firefighting. So that didn't go too well. So they took over, man. And, I started transitioning, like, I got to get out of this. So I started looking at arson, got into arson, couldn't get a job with the department. So I transitioned over to our PD department. So me and a couple guys, and we get hired by the police department, same county, get our picture taken for post, all that, go through all the testing, have my final interview, waiting on the chief interview. And I'm still waiting. I'm like, something's wrong. I already know if this place is going to, you know, can't let you go. We're too short. You know, all of our staffing problems that we created, can't let you go to the police side now. So you're stuck here. I'm like, no. But me and my wife are like, nope. So did my time, got all my PTO out of the way, took all of it, and I had 18 years, man. So a lot of PTO to burn. So eventually got out, went to the police side. Just night and day, man. I love the fire side. Nothing bad to say. I just have bad things to say about the command staff people. Loved who I worked with. Phenomenal folks. And police side was just very different. More military, for sure. Definitely more structured, more, and I did. I really like that part. I do like that. And then defensive tactics. Towards the end, we had a lot of staging instead. I'm not a big stager. I don't care for that at all. I like the police side where I can just go right in the front damn door and handle things too. That's who I am. I love it. So yeah, man, got on the PD side. Really, really loved it. Had some crazy calls, of course. One of my first things I want to do is drop my medic. I'm like, I'm done with EMS shit. I'm done. I don't have to do this. I'm a police officer, right? I think it was my third shift in. I get a cardiac arrest 10 minutes by myself. Nobody. So I'm like, you know what? I think I'm going to keep my EMS.
It's kind of handy.
Yeah. So I might have been done with it, but God had other plans. So it was, man. And it was good for the pass on. The firefighters like, who the hell's this dude? Like, what are you saying to us? You know, you're saying medic terms, you know, and all that. So it was funny, man. So, yeah. So and I've continued my medic. I'm going to be a medic 25 years here at the end of this year. So still do my medic, too, because, as you know, we beat fire in a lot. We're just faster and they're bunkering out. So we beat them to a lot of scenes. So it has definitely paid off, to say the least, man. It's been good.
Did you ever do the SWAT medic stuff?
I did not. No. My wife swore once I got off Swiftwater that there's never going to be a specialty team in my life. I've tried. If you could work on her, that would be great. But she's not letting me do it.
So what now, about, I've done enough. What about from the shift point of view, the transition from the mandatory world to what you were working as a cop?
Yeah, it was great. I don't think I did overtime the first 2 years, like hardly ever. It was awesome. You know, it was absolutely incredible. You know, you're 12 on. It's a different schedule. Sometimes it's two on, two off, two on, three off. It kind of rotates, but I love it. You know, our bodies, I'm so used to shift work that I just loved it. Absolutely. The only time you got stuck on a call was like a bad fatality or a murder. And then you were just waiting on someone to relieve you. But no, man, they want you out the door. And it was also flex time too. So if James stays till 7:05, you're leaving 5 minutes early tomorrow. And they want to make sure of that too. So, oh my God, just night and day, man. And just what a relief too. What a relief.
Well, let's talk about your mental health journey then. So you obviously you know, told the post-Swiftwater story. Yep. You know, where were some of the lowest points that you got to?
Definitely, you know, your child deaths, man. My real low was I can't remember. It's in my book. I think we had 8 fatalities in 12 days, maybe 5 kids. And, man, I just hit it. You know, I hit my low. Start drinking like a damn, you know, heavy. Because, you know, alcohol works. And that's the problem. But so what happens when something works? We do more and more and more. And then it doesn't work. And now you're in trouble, man. So a lot of fatalities. I asked for help, went to the chief. I still remember the conversation. I said, hey, man, my crew is phenomenal. Station 11, man, top notch. We run 85, 285 in Georgia, which is one of your busiest interstates, probably in the world, second to LA. And I was like, we need some help. And he's like, I don't think so, man. I think the guys are good. I'm like, I'm the lieutenant. I'm telling you, I know my crew. So he just yells out, hey, do you need help over there? You know, and of course, everyone's cutting up. Chief, I'm good. And I'm like, what the hell is this? He said he's good, lieutenant. Nothing else to say here. And that was like, wow. Okay. So I knew I was hitting a low, man. And I just knew I need to look in the mirror. I definitely had to start looking in the mirror. I actually wrote a letter to the deputy chief. I said, this crew's struggling. I'm one of them. I still had the letter. I might have trashed it a couple of years ago because it was just one of those things I held on to. And I said, we need help. The deputy chief came back and said, you are exactly like the water department, Pishock. You are no different at all. This is what you signed up for. That's what he said to me, the water department. I said, that's funny, chief, because I never saw him out at Christmas sitting out here in this freezing cold or outside of here ever. Because they ain't nothing like us at all. And I no disrespect. They ain't doing shit that we're doing on holidays and everything else here. So, yeah, this guy didn't care at all for any of us. So went to the chief and the deputy chief. So we hit, you know, back then we had CISM, CISD, and I was on the team because I had a lot of bad calls. So once you get all the bad calls, you kind of – you do a one-day class or whatever, and they're like, you're going on this team. You're going to go talk to this guy. And so I thought that would be better, but it was not good, man. It wasn't bad. Probably maybe 2014, 15, we had another bad fatality call. I can't remember if the mom killed the kid or whatever, but we had CISM come in too, and we were not happy. It was accumulation, of course, you know, your anger, your frustration, you don't know why. And we lashed out at these dudes, we're cursing up a storm, and these were two guys, headquarters personnel, who never could make it in the field. So we talked about, they probably did 2 years on the job, got up to headquarters as fast as they can, and now they are both captains, you know, 10 years in. Useless. And they came in this meeting and they said, if anyone curses in this meeting again, this meeting is over. So these are guys unloading on a diffusing, which you're supposed to do. So of course that brought every F-bomb in the world out from everybody in that meeting. They said, this diffusing is over. And they walked out of the damn station. So we all looked at each other like, who's going to help us now? Like, I guess we're it. You know, and all we had was anger and rage, and they literally got in their cars and drove away, man. So I just knew I had to continue on and just try to find my own path, really. I had to make my own path because there was no one to help, man.
So talk to me about that. What did that look like? What was the accumulation of tools that worked for you?
I went to EAP first. I wasn't sure, you know, went to my EAP and they're like, okay, we're going to give you a psychologist clinician. So I go there and I tell her about a child fatality and she starts crying. I'm like, this is not good. So I feel like the biggest piece of shit in the world because I just made the clinician cry. I made everyone else cry in my world. Now the clinician is crying and there's no one left. So not trauma specific, you know the deal. And she's like, I'm so sorry. I'm like, she's like, I apologize that you have to see this stuff every day. I'm like, yeah, I do. I got to do it tomorrow too. So that meeting ended horribly. So she sent me up with somebody else 2 weeks later. I start telling her some stories and I'm unloading, you know, and she's like, well, just quit. So I'm like, what do you mean? She's like, you need to quit. I said, ma'am, I need this job. At the time I had a kid, wife, a house. I said, I can't quit. She's like, well, this can't continue. I said, this is not an option. And that was her only solution for me. No tricks, no magic hocus pocus, nothing, quit. So I left her. So definitely have some problems with therapists to say the least. And I have no problem saying this right now. Therapists need to step up their game. And now that I'm a peer support coordinator, and I deal with a lot and sometimes trauma specific, it is not okay that we have to see 4 or 5 clinicians before we get help. Our suicide rates are insane. We're losing people constantly and therapists need to do better too. And the saying now, I hear it in all the damn seminars, sometimes you got to shop, it's going to take you 4 or 5. No. Do I have 4 or 5 chances to save that kid's life? I got one. And you have the same damn responsibility. So step up. That's my little thing there. Sorry.
Well, I think, I mean, you can have, I've had a lot of people in that world, you know, they have specialties, but the problem is, yes, and that a lot of the good, you know, culturally competent clinicians that, yes, I know, yep, are saying that, you know, you'll go on the site and they say they specialize in children and marriage and first responders, yep, and military, and that's just bullshit. You know, this is the problem, is that, you, right, know, if you don't work with us, that's great, but then don't advertise, yep, that you work with us, so then we don't, you know, shop that wrong person. But, yes, you know, I know there's also a high demand for, you know, yeah, mental health practitioners in our world. And it is a very specific area. Most people, I mean, we talked about, you know, some of your worst calls. I threw a couple, yep, of mine. You know, this is just, you know, in a week, you know, we have this, correct, you know, week in, week out. So it is, yes, a very unusual population. So, you know, that really should be one of the strong tracks in psychology that you can go to. But there should be stipulations that you cannot advertise that you are well versed in our population, correct, if you are not well versed in our population, because I've heard these EAP nightmare, yeah, stories so many times.
Exactly. And you nailed it. You totally nailed it. I went to one last year, trauma specific, said I need a trauma specific clinician. No problem. He's put me on hold, said, how does 3 weeks sound? I said, 3 weeks? I need to talk to someone now. They're like, we don't have anybody. I'm like, okay. Finally, I said, we'll send you somebody in a couple of days. I waited a couple of days. Went in there, talked to him. First thing he wanted to do was create a safe space for me. I just want you safe. I wanted the mood right. I'm like, is someone punking me? Is this a joke? Like, this is not what we do, man. And it was not good either. So that was not a good session either, man. And I have someone pretty good now. But most of the stuff I found is through getting into the peer classes. We have the journey took me about 2022. I went to this state Georgia class and man, it was a hell of a class. It woke me up. The stuff they were talking about, I wanted to like crawl under my seat because I was like, we don't talk about things like this ever. I couldn't believe people were actually discussing what is really going on. And then this was just the instructors who were just jam up, man. Of course they were in shootings. They had just horrible, horrible calls. And then they brought in the guest speakers, man. And the guest speakers, like, I was just spellbound. And then it kind of hit me, man. I'm like, this is my why. I'm going to use all my shitty calls for my entire life, and this is it, man. And that got me into my why and my purpose in life, and that's what I've done now the last 4 years, man, and that's where I am.
You mentioned that you finally found a counselor that was the right fit. What other tools have you found of help for you specifically?
Oh, yeah, I apologize. Definitely. So martial arts for sure, PT. PT's everything, man. It's probably the only thing that kept me alive when no one else could help me. Just super, yeah, I call it letting the demons out, man. Yeah, get outside. I have a garage gym, and we used to have guys who came over for years, and we just trained any martial arts. We just trained on the ground. I had some mats we threw down, and we just threw down for a while. But now it's just training my garage. Lift heavy kegs. I do a lot of sandbag work, a lot of HIIT workouts, 2 minutes on, 1 minute off, just super fast. Big into Wim Hof, man. I do breathing. I got to get my breathing in too. That is a necessity too. And then I journalize, helped me write my book, and putting things on paper really changed my life too. If you don't, it's all bullshit. There's no execution. Once you put it on paper and you wrote it and you see it, it's a total game changer too, man. So those three, I would say, would be the big things.
Beautiful. Well, mentioning the book then, you know, what gave you the idea to initially actually put together the book together, and then talk to me about the catharsis, if any, writing?
Sure. You know, trauma's funny. We talk about it. Blacks stuff out. It makes stuff disappear. And if we remember, man, I want to talk about a call. Remember Charlotte, if we can get to her. Just remember, okay. Charlotte, because it's a lot to do with trauma too. Thank you. Anyway, so I felt like trauma was stealing from me. I called the demons. They were cheating me. And I would be at work and I would start writing emails to myself about calls I was on. And I would send the email at home. So once I got home, I started saving it into a folder. So this is kind of my initial journalization, man. And had a hip surgery. I was out for a while. I said, might as well start this book. And that class just blew me away. And she said in the class, the teacher, she said, some of you in here, I'm going to open up your filing cabinet. I want you to be aware of that. I'm like, this chick don't know nothing, man. I remember saying, like, this chick's whacked. And then that night, man, James, I went to bed and the filing cabinet opened and all the damn burst that night, hands down. All the trauma came. Every call that I had blocked out, almost every call, because a lot of calls that I had blacked out. So started making phone calls, man. I called my buddy Black Cadillac. I'm like, hey, dude, did this happen? He's like, yeah, Pete. And then, remember this call? I'm like, no idea what you're talking about. He's like, you did this, this, and this. I'm like, no idea. So I started talking to other people just to make sure, man. I was like, did it actually happen, man? Because I literally blocked it out. I told you about the defense mechanism. So I started writing the book, man, and it was tough. You know, I wrote almost – I didn't write some of the pediatric calls. It was just too much. I just don't want to – I talk about them, but I don't want them on paper. It's just too much, man. But I wrote some – you know, just like you, I wrote some of the really bad calls. I got into high detail. I talked about the one girl who drowned, and I have no problem saying it. It took me 2 weeks to get through that chapter and a lot of whiskey. I couldn't get through it. And I reached out to another writer, man, and Michael Sugru, and he doesn't know me. And this was special too. And I said, Michael, I read your book. I loved it, but I can't write anymore. He wrote me back this incredible email. You have to do it. Your story's going to touch one person. I was like, here's a celebrity to me. Tell me this. And I'm like, and he helped me, man. He helped me get over that hump that I could not get over. And I continued writing, man. And, you know, you got to get naked in peer support world. That's the bottom line. You got to show your soul. And people know if you're honest and if you're full of shit real fast in this world, man. And wasn't even a couple of days, man. I sent it out. I started getting emails and messages about people, man, just saying thanks. And I was like, wow. Wow. Like, it worked. It was for me, for therapy, and one person. And then it made it to so many other people, man. And just even, you know, it's just incredible. It's absolutely incredible. And it's a scary journey, man, as you know, because you're putting your soul out there. And I'm still on the job. So I didn't know how that would go. You know, they're going to fire my ass right away. But it's worked out phenomenal, man. And getting my name out there in that regard, get a phone call yesterday. Hey, can we talk? I need to talk. And they just not unload. They just tell me their story. And I give them something back, man. And it's special, man. It is really special. I'm grateful.
I found that with the book, you know, with writing, but also with the podcast, it's amazing when, you know, people come on and they bare their souls, and you realize that all it is trust. That safe space of that one guy with the lighting and everything, the music, it's not that. It's just,
right.
Do you feel comfortable with this person? Are they willing to be vulnerable in the first place? You know, that's right. It. Yeah. And I'm sometimes just amazed that within minutes of a conversation, someone's just telling me their deepest, darkest story. And I'm just like, I'm humbled by it. Like, what a fucking honor to be someone that that someone feels comfortable enough to really be vulnerable, really be honest, really talk about, you know, what they're going through, because that's what we need. We're all good at the mask. That's what we do for a living.
Totally.
But the real courage comes from when you take the mask off.
Yes. Yeah, it is, man. And I've had two or three calls where people are in crisis about to end their lives. And that is the call, man. That's better than the rescues. That's better than that is something else, man. I remember telling that to somebody and they were like, man, I'm glad I'm not you. I'm like, what do you mean? Like, I couldn't handle that call. And I didn't get it. I was like, what do you mean? Like, what an honor to have somebody reach out to you literally about to blow their fucking brains out. And this is the last call. And it was you.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yep. But this is what this is all about. It's just being there as well. And the goal is obviously not to have the call when they're about to blow their brains out. The goal is to have a call, you know, three clicks back so that they're just starting to realize there's something wrong and you get to them then. Because back to the EAP, you know, you have a bunch of numbers pinned on a board. You get someone in crisis. Yep. They try one and it's disconnected now. And they're like, you know what? Fuck it. And then they do it.
Bingo. And that's it.
All I've said this many times. I've heard a lot of EAP nightmare stories. What breaks my heart is how many will I never hear? Because after that first time, the person was like, well, I am fucked. And then they just go and complete suicide.
Totally. And they make that phone call to you and your phone's on do not disturb or hung up. And of course, there's the guilt right there. That's that. But again, you can't be there for everybody. You try, man, but you have your own family too that has to have some priority or you're going to be dumped out of your life. You don't have enough. You got to be able to balance it.
Yeah. Well, I think this is that's something I've talked about recently. You know, you got Blake in Georgia. You've got, you know, Dustin Hawkins. You've got Mark Mikoski over in Georgia as well. A lot of these people who've put themselves out there, being vulnerable, and they are that beacon. But the problem is they become overwhelmed. I've seen it firsthand.
Definitely.
You know, because they're fielding all the calls now. And the goal is to have this conversation where ultimately it's a buddy system. You know, you just 100%. Literally find one person on the planet to be there for, and they're there for you. And that way, you know, it's highly unlikely that you're going to miss when something's wrong. But if everyone else is going about their business, well, we've got the peer support team. They'll handle it if there's anything wrong. We're missing the entire point of being a human being.
100%. I started the team, my new police department with Milton Police, and they're phenomenal, man. Just unbelievable. And I'm the team coordinator, and I'm putting together the team right now. So in Georgia, you have to go to this peer class. It's a 40-hour class to be a peer counselor. And I put my team together, man. I brought the state in. We did interviews, and they go at the end of this month. So they'll all be certified. So it'll be me plus six, and it's gargantuous. And I've already told a couple of them, like, listen, guys, I need you, like, ASAP. Like, I cannot handle all this stuff I'm getting, and I need to be able to talk to you and talk to somebody else who gets it. Because, you know, you can't spill anybody's – this is HIPAA and everything else, man. You're in trouble. So I said, I cannot wait till you guys are team members, man, so we can all share this load. And just be ready, man. It's heavy. And they'll go over that in the class. Like, you don't understand how heavy it is till the trauma stories keep one-upping each other. And you're like, good God, really? And then you just get stronger, of course, from it.
One conversation that I've been having recently that I realize, in my opinion, is the next phase now. We had this, you know, complete naivety, like, you know, suck some, rub some dirt in it, suck it up, buttercup. You know, the bullshit mentality, the Rambo, you know, generation. Then you had this, oh shit, no, there is something wrong. We're starting to have this conversation. And everyone was using the word PTSD. That's what we've got. Yep. Then we move forward more to understanding moral injury, you know, organizational betrayal, TBI, you know, operations syndrome, et cetera, et cetera. So now we're fragmenting and realizing, okay, there's lots of little pieces within this. But I think the next conversation that I think is probably the most important and the most positive is actually performance. This really became an aha moment when I saw some of the naysayers. You know, the guys are still hung on to that Robocop bullshit. And I was like, all right, then, tough guy. You know, if you don't think that this whole mental health thing is a real thing, let me put it differently. You now have all this shit banging around your head, but you're not addressing it. And now you're assigned to, you know, primary search on the second floor. And your mind's so busy that you can't even get to that flow state where you're actually able to paint the building with your hands and try and find that child who's actually hiding under the bunk bed.
Right.
If you want to operate at the high level in a gunfight, whatever it is, we know that you need a high level of stress, multiple repetitions, and a calm mind. And if you don't have a calm mind, you're never going to operate at a high level as a police officer, or a firefighter, or as a paramedic. Right. Yep. So what it made me realize on the physical side, on the mental side, is if we just focus on performance, not just, but that's like the main kind of conversation, that's going to pull everyone away from the crises as well, because we're using the same exact tool, counseling, you know, getting the right amount of sleep, you know, contrast therapy, you know, breath work, meditation, et cetera, et cetera. These are the tools that our tier one operators use, that our astronauts use, that all these high performance Olympians. They are using those. And so I think it's a really, you know, powerful conversation now to shift away from the, oh, it's so sad mental health conversation we've had for the last 10 years, and make it a positive conversation and not negate the fact that some people might be in crisis and bringing those in. But when those people are like, oh, no, you're just further back on the scale to this performance conversation that we're having. We don't want you to be just okay or just get back to work. We want you to get back to work and now be more resilient because of the shit that you've been through. That becomes a fucking superpower. And you're going to be more, you know, compassionate, more empathetic, and you're going to be able to operate at even higher level under stress because you've been through this stuff. Yep. So I feel like that's the next chapter of this mental health conversation in our profession, is to get away from, you know, oh, let's try and die less, which is our physical conversation. It's our mental conversation, to, well, let's talk about how we can shave, you know, half a second off your shooting time and how we can keep your heart rate low after you've climbed to the 10th floor before you do a primary search. That's the conversation we should be having. So I don't know, you know, what your perspective of that, but I feel like we need to almost kind of slough the old sad doom and gloom mental health conversation and reframe it to mental performance. And then obviously not negating the fact that some people's baseline at this point might be crisis, and we just got more work to do then.
Definitely. We started a group. I'm helping a group out. It's called Phoenix Fund. This guy, Will, runs it. Anyway, he's an Atlanta PD cop. And we started from North Georgia. It's once a month. We meet at a church. And it's basically it's trauma. You just come and it's run like an AA. So you just come, you can tell your story or just listen to others, man. And it's starting to go great, man. We're getting a bunch of different departments who show up. You know, of course, no recordings and like that. And you can just listen or you can talk, man. And we do, you know, we do diffusings, we do debriefings, but it stops after that too. There's no check-ins really per se. We were offering you your four sessions of therapy. This is great, man, in that you're in your street clothes. You don't have to talk about your department, and you just go and talk, man, if you want to. And we've had some just unbelievable stories already. And everyone in that group is just growing, and it's just word of mouth. And it's a nice next step that is not offered by any departments. And it's bringing anybody from North Georgia to speak. It's great.
Sounds amazing.
And that's just one part. But to me, too, it's an orientation-based thing. And I think that helps, too. Again, we got to transition. We're still losing way too many people. Most medications ever, most treatment ever, still suicides are through the roof. And everyone affects me. I mean, that's it. When I see it again on LinkedIn or Facebook, man, it hurts. It does. Like, I'm so over it, man. And when it's the same reasons. So I take it personally, too. And to me, it's in the orientations. We have some great departments who, day one, they start with your mental health, with your spouse, too. This is what Dennis is going to look like. This is how he's going to change. We need you to know this right now from the get-go. And that works, man. And we're going to continue this. And here's my phone number. And when you hear veterans open their souls up to rookies, man, it definitely works. It really works. And we just need that old guard to basically get out. Like you said, they still have that way. I'm good. Sure you are, man. Retirement. And then you lost your identity and already know what's going to happen. But I think we're doing better. I really do. But we got to do more. I have to do more. I think we all can.
Absolutely. Well, I want to throw some closing questions at you before I let you go. The first one I love to ask, is there a book or other books that you love to recommend? It can be related to our discussion today or completely unrelated.
I'm a reading fanatic, James. Fanatic. I usually read two books a night. Like, not totally, but I'll go be through for that. Man, one book I love for trauma and peer support, Terrorist Attack Girl. Have you read that one?
No, I haven't. I haven't even heard of that.
Oh, my God. Phenomenal. She is the female. I think her name is Miley. When the Nairobi terrorist attack killed 21 people, she was stuck in her hotel room. And it is intense. And I read it before peer support, and now I read it as a, quote, professional. Man, it's mind-blowing. So she journalizes the entire time as terrorists are going to kill her or whatever. And Christian Craighead came in and killed them all. That's another whole story. But her honesty and her journal, it's word for word, it's mind-blowing. It's only about a 200-page book too, man. But for therapy, yeah, that is one that I unbelievably recommend, especially if you're in the peer world.
Beautiful. What about documentary, film, or television?
I don't watch TV. I seriously don't. I am an anomaly. I am a workout fanatic and reading fanatic. I don't know. I haven't watched a movie in 10, 15 years. I can't even tell you.
That's admirable. It really is. All right. Well, the next question then, is there a person you'd recommend to come on this podcast as a guest to speak to the first responders, military, and associated professions of the world?
Did you have Mike Morgan on?
I did, yes.
You did. How about Pat Opian from used to be Atlanta PD?
That name doesn't ring a bell.
A-P-O-I-A-N is his last name, Pat. Pat's a former Atlanta police officer as well. On the job, got on a felony stop, got driven over on a burglary, and almost died multiple times. His story's pretty phenomenal. His road to recovery, and then finally the department just ditching him as well because they were done with him on his recovery. But incredible, incredible story and journey. I used to play ice hockey with him, and I heard him on a podcast, and it was stuff I never even heard. It's funny, like we talk about the honesty. Knew him forever. And then he goes on a podcast and tells these stories. I'm like, where did this come from? What the heck is this? And definitely recommend him for sure.
Brilliant. I'll look him up. Thank you.
Awesome. Yes, sir.
All right. Well, the last question before we make sure everyone knows where to find the book and you, what you do to decompress?
Decompress, definitely, like I said, workout. I work out tonight. It's non-negotiable every single day. Has to be done. I did my breath work in the morning. I make sure. And I do a grateful journey, man. That's what I do. Try to do it in the morning, but it's three things, the three things I'm grateful for. You'll be on one of it. You'll be one of them this time. And, you know, it's either my wife, my family, my dogs. I try to make it vary, and then I'll write a paragraph about each one. And to me, that is unloading, man. It just shows that no matter what I went through, I'm so grateful for this life and everything I have.
Love it. Yeah, I don't do a paragraph, but I do the gratitude journal in the morning and in the evening.
Good.
And it's
awesome.
Yeah, it's amazing when you're forced to think about something that you're grateful for, it completely reframes what you haven't got.
Totally. It does, man. It really does. It's a game changer. And I just started maybe a year or two ago, and it's changed my life. It really has.
Beautiful. All right. Well, then for people listening, the book is Demons and Angels. Where can they find that? And then where are any places to find you online?
Yes, sir. So the book's on Amazon, Demons and Angels. It's only on Amazon. You can get it in any format, of course. I got to pull my stuff up so I remember. Website is pshockbooks.com. It's my last name, pshockbooks.com. LinkedIn, it's just my name, Dennis Pshock, and my Instagram is Pshock's Patriots. And that's it. I don't do Facebook, so that's all my links right there.
Brilliant. Well, Dennis, it's been an amazing conversation. We've gone all over the place from Swiftwater Rescue to organizational betrayal and everything in between. I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time and coming on the Behind the Shield podcast today.
Thanks, James. Incredible honor. I'm so happy. Thank you so much for having me.